you very much, and thank you everybody for joining us here this morning. It's been already an exciting day, I'm sure, for everybody, and full of inspiration for all of us. And we're about to get more insight from Jody Conrad, who is in 38 years as a collegiate head coach. Her team won 900 games, but what was really special about that and beyond that was her players, 99% graduated from the university. So congratulations on those two fronts. So we're going to welcome Jody and find out a little bit more insight on some of the themes that you brought up this morning. And as was mentioned, this is Q&A. We want this to be interactive. We don't have all the questions and answers up here, so we want to hear from you. So I'm not sure if these microphones are working down here for people to come up or just wave your hands, shout, whatever, to get our attention. Ask your questions whenever they come to you. So, but to kind of get things started here, one of the things that you mentioned this morning was a part of being a leader and part of being a team also is infusing enthusiasm and passion and fostering that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you did that with a team and how, since you mentioned also that a lot of things that happen in sports apply to the workplace.
No question. First of all, I want to say about this group, I already know the people that would be ready to go in if called upon. Because when you sit on the bench as a coach and you start thinking that you need to change something, somebody needs to go in the game, you look down the bench. And those people that are leaning forward as you in the front of the room are, I know you're ready. If you're doing this as I'm looking for somebody to substitute, I'm pretty sure that I'm not going to feel real confident sending you into the game. So I really can't see everyone, and I'm used to being in a smaller environment. So it's stand up and stomp or hold up your hand. There is no real format to this. You can ask a question as we go along. It doesn't. You don't have to wait till the end. And I can tell you that even if I don't know the answer, I'll make up something. And I won't necessarily always answer your questions.
Okay. That's fine.
Used to that. First of all, it's really fun to be in a group of women, women who are motivated. How do I know you are? Because you're here. You've taken your time. I know how busy everyone is, but you're here. You're anxious to share. You're anxious to learn. And I'm no different from any of you. Every one of us has a story. My story happened to unfold in a fairly public arena, but it is no more significant than yours. I had an opportunity to grow up in a very small town, and there were a lot of advantages to that. Because I gained a lot of confidence. Because you do everything in the small town and in the small school, you believe you can. So I had a very diverse opportunity to be in plays, to play sports, but mostly to feel like it was okay to do whatever I wanted to do. The only thing I thought I couldn't do was choose a profession outside of teaching or maybe nursing, because those were the only women I saw doing things other than the women who were raising a family, being at home, and certainly that's a worthwhile objective, but I think it was limiting in terms of what I felt like I could do on a professional level. And isn't it great now that we're in an environment where young women can see people who look like them doing all kinds of things? And it changed dramatically. Unfortunately, it took a federal law to change things in a real significant way, and that's Title IX. It doesn't say anything about sports at all. It was about equal opportunity for people on collegiate campuses to be whatever they wanted to be. No discrimination. And that opened up the doors. Sports happened to be one of the more visible things that started to evolve out of that. But prior to Title IX, I think there were very few women in law school, very few women pursuing medical degrees. I don't remember early on seeing any women pilots. So there are all kinds of things that happened as a result of that law. And it changed the world for all of us as women. It changed all of the world in terms of how society views women and how it appreciates their very special talents. I do remember part of the question. Motivation is interesting. You know, everyone thinks that the coach is the motivator. I have found it totally impossible to motivate people that aren't inwardly motivated. I think you try to surround yourself with people who are equally motivated. And yes, there can be the enthusiasm and the motivation gained from others. And it is truly, I think, the most important motivator is peer pressure. That can be positive and it can be negative, but you try to build on that in a team setting. It's not about the authority figure all the time. You know that. Your children know that. We don't need the authority figure to tell us how to do things and to tell us the decisions to make. Hopefully, we're all on the same page in terms of making good decisions, what's right and wrong. But more often than not, it is our own personal responsibility to be motivated, to be energized, to be committed, to be all the things I talked about this morning. But even more than that, to make sure that you hold yourself accountable. Right now, I think we're dealing with a generation that has been parented in a different way. And many times, parents assume the responsibility for their children, even when it would be better if the children were doing that themselves. So just a word about the motivation that you feel. I know you're extremely motivated as individuals. I know that you're probably extremely motivated for your children to do the right thing. But that motivation has to come from them. And it's a learning process. It is something that is not easy. But obviously, I can tell you things that might remind you to be motivated. I might be able to tell you stories that would make you think about what's important to you. But in terms of motivating you, it's way overrated. Coaches don't go into the halftime and give some kind of dynamic speech and a light comes on. Usually halftime and pregame is about reminding you of the things that you have practiced and reminding you of the things that you are good at and reminding you that we're all in this together. And for the most part, motivation is important. It's really hard to motivate people who aren't self-motivated. But when you can surround yourself with people that are, it's the grandest feeling in the world because you have an advantage to do something that you could only dream about as an individual, but as a group, you can be way above your expectations.
You mentioned about parents and kids, because I would imagine trying to infuse that, it doesn't start too early. And letting them have responsibility and accountability.
Absolutely. How many of you have children that play sports? Okay. How many of you have encountered issues that you needed to counsel them about what was happening? Okay. Some thoughts, and I'm not the expert on all of this, but I can tell you the kind of young women that I enjoyed coaching. And it wasn't limited to college-age students. I was at the University of Texas as the basketball coach for 32 years. Every summer, we had a basketball camp for children as young as 8 all the way up through high school. And we had an average of about 1,200 students a summer. So if you multiply 1,200 times 32, I bet there might be some campers in this room because I run into people all the time who say, remember me. And I can probably have a pretty good percentage of saying you are a camper and be right. So I know and I've observed young people as they try to find their way in a team setting, try to find their identity, try to find their self-confidence. And I think it's important, it's huge when parents support in that effort. some of the saddest situations I've observed is when a child is playing in a sport and they're good and they're having fun and they're enjoying it and their parents are not there. They never come. They never watch. They never are there to celebrate with children. And the most exciting thing is how involved families can get in the sports experience. I recruited a young woman from a little big town, Shallow Water, if any of you from the Lubbock area. And as the rules dictate, students sign a letter of intent in the fall of their senior year that commits them to that institution. So you have the opportunity of knowing they're going to be in your program, but you watch them through their senior season, and you stay in contact with them and make sure that everything's going fine so that they're going to be prepared. So one Sunday afternoon, I called a young woman. I think it was April. I think her season was already over. And I called on a Sunday afternoon just to check, and her name was Jonna. And she lived in this house with a younger sister, and the younger sister's name was Amanda. And when I called, Amanda answered the phone. I said, "Hi, Amanda, is Jonna there?" She went, "No, ma'am, she's at the gym shooting." I said, "Well, is your mom there?" She went, "No, ma'am, she's at the gym rebounding." So I knew that not only had Jonna developed her skills, worked on her own, and been self-motivated, but I knew that she was supported by a family that cared. Not so much cared about what kind of basketball player she was going to be, but cared about supporting her dream. If her dream was to do this, then I'm going to be totally supportive of that, and I'm going to do what I can. But you have to remember, it is your children's dream. It is not yours. And I know that many of you in other generations may have been deprived of an opportunity to be a part of a sports team. But at the same time, you have to let them find their way. And I might say that I don't think it's realistic for an 8-year-old to have to decide that they're going to play one sport and one sport only, and that's what they're going to do, because all of these adults say, well, if you don't start playing now, and if you don't decide your sport, you're not going to get a college scholarship, and you're not going to... I haven't ever recruited an 8-year-old. So I think they have some time to make those decisions. And one of the things I value most about my little hometown is I played everything. I was pretty good at some things, and I had that experience. And I was really bad at some things, and I had that experience. And it was okay to fail. And I didn't have my parents. If my parents had gone up and said, well, why isn't my child getting to be this on this team, or why isn't she getting to play, I would have been mortified. And I think we have to allow our children to have their own experience. I think you have to let them have some success and celebrate with them. You have to let them have some failures. I hated coaching a young woman who, when she came to my level, I felt like she'd never heard the word no. Because people who have no difficulty and no disappointment and no consequence of actions are going to have a really hard time somewhere in life. So what better opportunity for them to experience that in a sports environment where it's not a matter of life and death, and it is something that they can benefit from and something that they can grow from. Those summer camps, if one out of every summer got to go to a college on a college scholarship, that was good. The other 1,200 of them were probably not going to play, maybe not even past seventh grade, but they were going to learn lessons that I consider life lessons, because that's what happens when we're in an environment where there's success, there's failure, you very seldom have perfection, and you're trying to do all this surrounded by other people who are either helping you do it or they're trying to keep you from doing it. So what kinds of lessons can you learn from that? It's huge.
You mentioned about that okay to fail, and one of the things you mentioned this morning, that in addition to, you know, the championship is great, but it was the adversity and the risk-taking that got you there, and, you know, got the
Absolutely.
Team there. So, you know, how is it that you can foster that sense of not shying away from taking a risk or facing adversity?
I think by nature, we're risk takers. Sometimes women have not been allowed to step forward and to be, there was a time where if you said, you described a woman as saying she was competitive, that brought all kinds of negative thoughts. But I think we're past that, hopefully. Hopefully we all, how do we know what we can be if we don't take risk? And how do we know how to compete unless we practice it? And I can't imagine that there's any job out there today where competition isn't a part of it. You're always comparing yourself, probably to someone else, but certainly to yourself. That's what we do in everything. Okay, I did this, this is where I was today, tomorrow can I be better? So I think sports teaches that. If you play basketball and you foul five times, there's a consequence. And it doesn't matter if the player cries, the coach can stomp and yell, mother can come out of the stands, none of that matters. You still are going to have to sit on the bench because the consequence of five fouls is you can't play anymore. What better lesson is there to be learned by that? And I know, okay, I didn't make the A team. Is there a lesson to be learned there, or is it a time for us to have a pity party? I think every one of those experiences makes people stronger. Just remember, Michael Jordan did not make his high school basketball team until he was a sophomore. He didn't make a team until then. So just because your children don't make the team when they're 8 or 9 or 10, that doesn't mean that they're not going to have a positive experience with the experience of playing, and maybe they're on the JV or the blast team. But that in itself is a life lesson. And I don't think you want your children, and I don't think you want to be in an environment where everything is always grand and glorious and there are never any ups and downs because you're living in some kind of fairyland that doesn't exist for most of us today. So take the experience. Make it a teaching situation. Everything that happens through sports has some consequence and some teachable moment. And you have to remember that teachable moments are the most important times for people to learn lessons. I could sit here and lecture a child about this is how you do, and when this happens, do this, and this is the response. But those are not going to be as significant and as meaningful as if you wait till that situation arises and then you make your point.
Now, that makes me think of kind of the next level for you as a coach. You had to go through some development yourself in developing those skills and becoming as effective as you were. What were some of the risks that you identified for yourself and learned from?
Well, as I mentioned, to expand a little bit on the idea, okay, I think I can be a teacher. I think I can be maybe a nurse, although I didn't see those very often. I go away to school, I want a profession, I want to be a teacher. And I'm on that track. And suddenly I feel a real void in my life. I've played sports, I've been a part of a team, I felt camaraderie and connection, and I'm in a different environment, and I'm trying to make my way and meet new friends, and I'm going, wait a minute, I really, really miss basketball. I miss playing, and I'm good at it. And that caused me to pursue, just go to the gym and see if anybody's playing. And surprisingly, I walked in there and there were actually women playing. And that allowed me to get involved. And again, it took me a while to understand that a woman could be a coach, because even at the high school level at that point, and I did follow high school basketball across the state, there were very few women. And it just happened that I came along at a time and was observed by a man who was coaching basketball at a high school outside of Waco. I do have to tell people sometimes that I went to Baylor. People ask me, how did somebody with a Baptist background and 2 degrees from Baylor get to a place like the University of Texas? And I generally try to be truthful and say that the Lord calls us to do missionary work in various places. So it all worked out. But he observed me in class, and he observed me playing basketball on an extramural, which was a glorified intramural team. And he asked me to come and be an assistant coach. And that was the first time I really thought that I might be able to do that. And it was a wonderful happenstance because he was a very successful man who happened to also be the superintendent of that school district. It was Midway School District outside of Waco. Some of you may be familiar. He had been the superintendent of that school for a long time, and he started as a coach in several sports, but loved coaching the women because he said they listened, and they didn't think they knew everything, and it was easy to build a successful team. So he had aspirations to eventually give up that position, and he brought me and mentored me and taught me what I needed to know to become a coach. And that, I think, as I was learning about the sport and the X's and O's, I simply had to look around and take things from men because they were far advanced in what they were doing and how long they'd been in the profession. I did things like send $5 to a coach named Dean Smith at North Carolina to get an explanation of how he played a certain defense. So that $5 was a really good investment because it became my philosophy on how to teach defensive strategy. So you take what you can get from whoever you can get it from. And coaching is, there's not anything original in coaching. Everybody copies somebody else, and hopefully you copy people that are successful. And I think that's a big part of what mentoring is. Find somebody that you admire, somebody that you respect for what they do, and then steal everything you can from them. But I would say that you have to have your own personality. One of the other coaches that I really admired and who has more national championships on the men's side than anybody was a man named John Wooden. And he was super successful. But he was so soft-spoken and so intellectual and so matter-of-fact and very, I think had started out as an English teacher. And I couldn't be John Wooden because my personality was not like his. So I had to know that I have to be myself. Young people figure out right away who is authentic and who's not, who's honest and who's not, and who's truthful and who is true to themselves. And I think we all have to find that. All of us shy away from people that we think are fake, people that we think are not genuine. And the best quality we have is to be ourselves. Everybody has strengths and everybody has weaknesses, which is another good thing about a team. If you're on a team with diverse groups and diverse skills, then you can cover everybody's weakness with everybody else's skills of strength. So that's the best team. Cover your weaknesses. If I have a weakness, my weakness might be ball handling. Well, I don't have to do that. Somebody else on my team is really good at it. So I have to let her assume that role. But mentorship is important. And I think you all have probably could think of somebody today. And maybe you are a mentor. I think that becomes the other part of it. I got a lot of helping hands along the way. And at the University of Texas, it was really important, I think, to all the coaches that we put people in an environment where they can be their best academically, and that was huge because you can't be here unless you are, that you're in an environment where you can showcase your talent. That's what we all want to do. We would all like to showcase what we can do. And third, that you have to give back. Because there's no way that you get to be of the elite of all athletes in the country that somebody didn't give you a boost along the way. And women have to know this, and it's not an easy thing. Isn't it amazing to you when a woman finally reaches the pinnacle and she's aloof and unapproachable and unwilling to help? It's almost like we take the attitude, hey, I'm here. I had to work really hard to get here. Now you do whatever you have to do. I don't think men are quite that way. They learned earlier because they had experience and because they had opportunity. to pull each other along. And I look at coaching and I'm going, especially on the men's side, and I'm going, this guy's been fired from four jobs, but he's still going to get another coaching job because he's part of the good old boys group. They just have that way of pulling people along, even if they're not qualified to be.
And I'm thinking with how, you know, you mentioned about Title IX changing a lot of things, and there still are those non-traditional roles to break into, but as things start to even out, shall we say, I guess that will be a more important role for women to play once they reach a leadership role.
Absolutely. It was always really important to me to have a diverse group of young women based on race. Because I think about the head coaches at the University of Texas, and we have a very strong African-American woman who coaches our track team. And I have to take credit for hiring her. I served as athletic director, but it was important. She was really, really good. But we had so many African-American students, who do they see that looks like them? They need to know that they can be a boss. They need to know that there's a role and an opportunity for everybody to progress. And I think, we can talk forever about whether affirmative action is important or not important. But if we are dependent on the skills of a diverse population, then there needs to be that image of people in different races, religions, in positions of authority so that we allow others to see themselves in those same roles.
And that reminds me of the story that you told this morning, and you mentioned already about, you know, you can have weaknesses on a team. The story you told about the player who's 5'4", didn't necessarily have the stats, and yet had a certain skill that was magic on the court. But it was a skill that's not necessarily easily identifiable. So how does that happen, to make that connection?
Well, I think if you're in an organization, or and certainly if you're a coach, you recognize skills that might not stand out to everybody else. You know what the nitty-gritty is of your profession or your job or your business. And you know the people that are capable of doing the nitty-gritty. And you know how important they are to you. And the quality that, if you were in the session this morning, I talked about was making everyone else around you better. It's back to that accountability thing. A leader has to be accountable first. If you're not accountable as a leader, then you can forget it. They can give you whatever title they want to give you, and you are not going to be successful. Because we only respect people that are accountable. We only respect people that are efficient at what they do. And therefore, accountability comes along. And if you're a person who is brave, bold, however you want to say it, aggressive, if you're the kind of person who can go to your teammate and say, you need to run the floor harder. I have an example. This person she's talking about, 5'4", point guard, couldn't really score, couldn't jump, wasn't that fast, but she demanded by her energy and by her commitment that everybody else around her give the same kind of commitment. And it was hard for her as a freshman. She didn't want to be the boss on the floor, and there has to be a boss on the floor. There has to be communication. So I was always saying, Cammy, you must be vocal. You must. They don't know what they're doing unless you call out the play in a way that they can hear it. And I've given you the power to do that. I can't do it from the bench. You must do it. You must demand. So little by little, she would, you know, assert herself. And there was one day in practice where she yelled at a player, one of the most intelligent players on the team, one of the best players on the team. She said, get there, in an assertive voice, meaning Cammy's dribbling the ball, the basket's out there, she wants this player to run hard to the basket so she can make the pass and we can score. And that player turned around to her in the midst of all this and said, I'm going. it was a teachable moment. I called those two over and I said to the one who said, I'm going, what have I been telling Cammie to do for the last 2 months? Be vocal. Tell us what to do. I said, so the first time she did it, you talked back? So I'm sure she muttered under her breath and went on, but it's the kind of thing that you have to use those times, and you have to reinforce people that you have put in power to use that, and you have to use your ability as a manager, as a coach, to create the environment. You can't do everything. You cannot be responsible for everything. Let me give you an example. I was so fortunate as I was at the University of Texas in a visible role that there were a lot of women, strong women around in Austin. Barbara Jordan, for example. And if I were telling a group of young women that I was coaching, they wouldn't know who the heck I was talking about, because if it hadn't happened in the last 10 minutes and it's not about them, they don't know. But Barbara Jordan would come to the games, and part of our selling tickets, let's get people that are really visible and credible to come to the women's games, and then other people see them there, and they think it's important. So there was a strategy. So Barbara Jordan and Ann Richards are going to come to the games. Barbara became an instant expert, just how that's her personality. And they both sat near the bench, so they had this feel special to get them there. Well, Barbara had one of those voices, you know, that if she said something, it was so booming and demanding, you felt like you should go out and join something. And I had to tell her all the time, Barbara, you cannot be yelling at the officials like that. They're going to give me the technical. But she might, in the middle of a really tight game, say, can we not shoot any better than this? And I think I might say, no, no. And on the other hand, would be much more likely to tug on my coattail and say, where'd you get those shoes? So they were around the program, which was a tremendous advantage to our student athletes. So I asked Barbara to come and talk to our players, and she wanted to talk about ethics and responsibility and leadership. She gave them a hypothetical situation. She said, okay, you are a team that is coming to practice, and as you come to practice in the Irwin Center, there's one of your teammates is sitting in a car in a parking lot talking to her boyfriend. And everybody else comes to practice, you come onto the floor, you start practice on time, the player who is in the car with a boyfriend comes 10 minutes late. And comes up to the coach and says, I had an exam and it took me longer than it was supposed to. My teacher kept me. And I might be the coach and I would accept that as a answer, and we move on, we go through practice. So, okay, Barbara posed the question, what should those players on the team do? And obviously they could give one of a multiple of questions. A lot of them said it's the coach's responsibility. Never mind that the coach didn't go through the parking lot and see the player sitting there. All right, nobody wanted to be the one that went and told. So what should have really happened? After practice, the players should have taken that player aside and said, you are hurting our team by doing that. Don't do it again. Do you think that would have solved the problem? Absolutely. But it's a hard thing to do. But it is about not only you're being responsible, but you're helping other people assume their responsibility. Hard thing, really hard for women. But your teams are not going to win championships unless you do it. I can just promise you that.
Well, you mentioned about that teachable moment, and what I found kind of, I got to remember this, is to jump on it. You saw what happened and you acted immediately, as opposed to, you know, sitting back, waiting, that sort of thing. And there's got to be some type of confidence, some type of just watchful eye that leaders need to have to know when to jump in, when to not jump in.
Absolutely, and that comes with taking responsibility. It's a hard thing for us. It's not a popular thing a lot of times. But I can think of a very current event that's happening. What was our judgment on the guy that saw the Penn State coach in the shower with a 10-year-old? What was the responsibility? He had to sleep on it overnight. It's always difficult, and hopefully no one's ever in a situation that's that dire. But I think we do see those situations, and if you are the leader of your group or aspire to be, then you have to do the hard things. You can't always do the things that you think are going to make you popular. And that advice to your children is also critical.
And then the other story you were mentioning about, the peer pressure part of it, the culture that develops in the team, and that takes a lot of work to develop over time, and yet you're also dealing with turnover, which obviously a lot of us deal with in the workplace. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of it.
It's interesting. I had a conversation with one of my former players not very long ago. We were going to do a little TV thing. And we were reliving, and it happened to be reliving the national championship team. So I have two players, one on either side of me and on a television set, and we're talking about it. And the question was, what was it special about that team that went undefeated, 34-0, perfect season? What was special about that? Because if that happens once in your lifetime, you're really lucky. Right now is the beginning of basketball season. I was thinking today, 300 Division I women's teams all have their goal is one prize. What is it? That championship. Now, in today's society, we would tend to say, well, you all tried. Here's a participation ribbon. Right? I have some issues with that, too. So what creates an environment where one team can achieve that and 299 fall by the wayside? In that setting, this was a team that had all those seniors on it. One freshman comes into that environment in their senior year, and she's more talented than any of them, but she's a freshman. And she gave the example. She said, when I came on my recruiting visit, we played touch football. And she said, it was so competitive. I had sisters on that team. The two sisters got in a fight over what down it was. She said, I just figured out right away that this was going to be competitive and I better bring my best game. So there is something to be said of creating that environment. The coach can't do it on their own. You have to surround yourself with people who understand that competition is fun. We want to shy away from that sometimes. It is fun. And I see today's young people, they want everything to be okay. And women are like this in a lot of ways. If you contrast how men play and how women play, the men, you figure out right away who's in charge. If they're just out there playing a pickup game, right? What do women do? They don't want anybody to be above anybody else. Let's all play right here on the same level and nobody take any kind of responsibility. Well, I'm telling you, you don't move anywhere. What drives teams to be good is, here's the best player. I want to be like that person. And I'm going to work to get there. And as soon as everybody starts working to be better than they are, then you have a competitive environment. And that environment has to be there if you're going to really accomplish special things. Question? Yes, please. I have a gymnasium voice, and if you do, you can tell us, but...
What a ball. Can you hear me? I'm kind of talking.
Hello. Hi there. Thanks for being brave.
First, it's so wonderful to be around you because I played college sports and I've always heard stories about how great you were as coach, so it's an honor to be in your presence.
Well, thank you. You didn't talk to all my players.
Only a few. But for most of us coming from a business environment, I know you've talked a lot about coaching and you've talked about the players and the aspect of that environment. What about as your peers began to also catch up to you in your achievements? I know you've spoke about Tennessee and UConn as well. You having the tenure and obviously working very hard to get to where you were and had experienced that already, but to see the media jump on the bandwagon of these up-and-coming coaches, how did you make sure that you maintained your composure and talk to your team even through that when they're probably saying, well, my coach is better? How are you able to be the real you and be the best that you could be even in that environment with your peers?
That's a really good question. And I think a lot of times we start out at one level and we really don't know what the standard is. The standard is whoever's in your profession that is up there. And that you always are going to have a standard. You're always going to have a standard as an individual, and you're always going to have a standard as a team. And that doesn't change. I think, again, it's that one prize. You may not get there, but you've got to keep moving. All right, say you were it. You were up above everybody else. What motivates you to keep moving? If you don't keep moving, everybody catches you. And, yes, I can definitely relate to that. When the University of Texas was its most dominant, we had leadership and the determination that we weren't going to be limited by what anybody else said. We were going to go out and do our thing. And we were going to do it, and we were going to change the world in terms of how people viewed women's basketball. And I think we did that to a certain degree. And at that point, nobody else paid much attention because they didn't think anybody. If I heard it once from the media, I heard it a dozen times. Well, we're not going to talk about women's basketball because nobody cares. And, you know, my response is going to be, well, why, how do you know that if they don't know anything about it? So it was always the chicken and the egg. It was always the excuse. We're not going to cover it because nobody's going to read it. Well, they're not going to read it if it's not out there to read. So you're always fighting that. So you can't get frustrated by it. You simply have to keep your eye on what your goal is and do it the way you think it should be done and move forward. And then when everybody else starts catching up with you, then you have to re-energize. You have to rethink. You have to go back to square one and say, what did I do to get here? And now I've got to have new ideas and a new way. And I looked at it in the sense that, hey, if everybody wanted to be like the University of Texas, then that's a good thing. Because we need to not be so self-absorbed that we can't see the bigger picture. How did women's basketball grow? It grew because other people decided they wanted to be better too. So which was better? For the University of Texas to continue up there to be number one, to just beat people off and never have any competition? My perspective changed totally. I don't like going to those games that are blowouts. Now that I'm not coaching, I loved them when I was on the bench. I want to go to a game that's competitive. So now, okay, I only won one championship. There were lots of seasons. I felt like teams didn't reach their potential. The media jumps on it. If you ever set a really high standard, then you can expect that the media is going to beat you down when you don't maintain it. That's just the way it is. But my perspective was always, if I did any little thing to help, there'd be a lot of opportunities for young women to participate, then I'm going to be okay with that. And the farther I move away from active coaching, it's not about wins and losses. It is about the landscape of women's athletics changed over that period of time where I was coaching. I was only a little bitty part of it, but I can take a lot of pride in that. And if we had to set a standard to start out and then everybody tried to reach that standard, then you have to assume that the prestige of the group and that the group became even more productive. But somebody's chasing you. There's no question. You know, there's so many cliches in sports. There's always somebody behind you, and you better keep running. And it's hard being in a business where everybody knows if you failed or succeeded. It's the front page of the sports page. And that's hard. And that's a hard lesson for young people. I look at what happens to young people who choose to play at the highest level. I look at the young man who came to the University of Texas as a quarterback, the best in the country, everybody said. And suddenly he's the starting quarterback, and now we're not doing what everybody thinks we should do, and everybody's jumping on him and writing bad things about him. And I don't know how his parents handle it, but I do know that they handle it in really the best way possible. So you have to understand that criticism, if you're not getting criticized, then you're probably not in doing everything you can do.
I have a question right here.
Yes.
Can you hear me here?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, first, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. You're part of the reason that I went to UT, and my sons are both at Baylor, so I'm kind of and actually, one of them is a manager there, and we had a discussion about McCreary and what he should have done, and, you know, and I told him at the beginning that for what we had heard that he just left, and then went and called his dad, I said, I have to tell you, if one of you guys did that, I'd be ashamed. Because you didn't take that extra
right.
But then, you know, the smarter Rachel came back and he goes, yeah, well, I'd never coach again. Remember what happened to the guy at Baylor?
Right.
Which, if Baylor, you know, years ago had a mess with their basketball program, and again, one of the assistant coaches turned in his, and actually to take
him right.
His coach, and not forgotten. He doesn't play basketball. They both want to coach basketball. So what, I mean, I can tell them from a mom's perspective
right.
what I thought the right thing is to do, but I tell them I thought maybe someone.
Most of you couldn't probably hear all of that, but she was talking about a couple of negative situations. The Notre Dame situation where the assistant coach saw the act in the shower and, as has been reported, didn't do anything, slept on it overnight, then went to his supervisor. And the Baylor situation where a player, there were multiple violations of rules. There was disregard for student athletes and their well-being, and it resulted in a horrible situation. What do you do if you're going to tell your supervisor or the authorities or the police or whoever it might be something that you saw that might jeopardize your job? I think we all have to rely on our moral compass. And the moral compass that we have has been developed over time. And your children's moral compass has been developed over time. And I think you have to be honest with yourself. And that, I think, is an individual issue, but at the same time, I think most of the time, doing the right thing pays off. Maybe you're not going to be able to pursue your own profession, as that she indicated. These guys may never be able to coach again. But somebody is going to respect what they did, that they did the right thing, and somebody is going to want to be surrounded by those people. And, you know, the whistleblower thing is in our vision right now. And that, I think, we have to reward those people. And that is all going to take some time. Because I think in our society, we have seen over and over people making selfish decisions. And hopefully those selfish decisions do not have rewards that are long-lasting. So we can only encourage and remember that we all know what our moral compass is, right or wrong, and when you deviate from that, then the consequence that you feel is probably not going to be one that you can live with.
Are there any more questions?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I still do have a job. People think I don't. My title at the University of Texas now is Special Assistant. So as you can imagine, if your title were that in your organization, that meant you do whatever anybody thinks of. And when people think you don't have a job, it's hard for me to say no to anything. I don't have that ready excuse. But I do feel an obligation. I do feel a responsibility to help people. I don't paint the rosiest of pictures. If I'm mentoring someone, I want them to know the truth. I always say to them, if you can live without coaching, don't do it. Because it has some real highs, but it has some real lows. And I think if you followed that with whatever you do, that you would probably make the correct career choice. Because you can't replace passion. If you love something, then you don't feel like you have a job. It's what you want to do. I saw somebody said, you love a sport, but coaching is making somebody else love it. And I think that's what you have to think about if you really want to be a coach, if you want to be anything. And, you know, all these things I've talked about coaching, these same principles apply to choir, to band, to any group of people that come together with a common purpose. You're in a group setting, you want to stand out, no question. Every player I've ever coached wants to make All-American. But you've got to figure out how to showcase your talent through the support of your team, because you cannot do it by yourself. And I think mentoring is important to do it on a formal basis. But I think a lot of us mentor every day when we set an example, when we do something that other people think they want to do. And the difference in what those of us that were early on in our professions that were non-traditional did is that we had to really prove ourselves. And maybe women have to do that at a lot of levels now. You just got to get in there and work. It's not going to happen overnight. Nobody's going to take a magic wand and say, you are this. You have to go through the stages. And that's hard for young people today to envision. They're pretty entitled. If they say they want to coach, they're talking about taking my job. They're not talking about going to the junior high and teaching that level. So, and we've done that. We've created this entitlement thing. Remember, everybody gets a participation award. You give somebody an award because they tried. Aren't they supposed to try? I can't imagine that we're separating people from trying, and this side's trying, and this side's not trying. So it's okay to have to earn something. It's okay to have to go and do the menial things to start out. When I started out, my first coaching job, assistant coach to MT Rice at Midway, I was coaching the junior varsity team. And we had this big tournament at Christmas. And you wanted your team to advance because we all had all the men and women coaches. They all had different teams at different levels, and everybody was in a bracket. And you wanted to keep winning because when your team was out, you had to go work in the concession stand. So it was a motivator to keep winning. So I think if we can tell everybody there are going to be the nitty-gritty things that nobody wants to do, you have to do those. If you don't have that experience, how are you going to have any appreciation of people that do it? And I figured out early on, if I'm going to coach, there are two people I need to know first and foremost. The janitor, because I'm going to need this floor swept at some point, and somebody that's got keys to the closet so I can get things out of there that I need. And that wasn't the principal, the superintendent, or anybody else. It was the people that do the day-to-day jobs and do it in a way that you can depend on them. One last story. There were these three men who were out in the wilderness, and they got lost, and they're trying to find their way back, and they come on this raging river, and they can't figure out. They know they've got to get across the river to get back to where they belong, but they don't know how to do it. So they started to think, and the first man said, okay, I'm going to pray. God, please give me the strength to get across this river. And poof, all of a sudden his arms and his legs started to grow, and now they're long, and he jumps in and he swims as hard as he can, and after an hour he gets to the other side. So the second man looked at all that and he said, okay, I'm going to try that. So he goes, God, give me the strength and the ability to get across this river. And a boat shows up. So he gets in the boat and he rows across, and he gets across in half an hour. The third man is there and he's going, okay, it worked, I'm going to try it. God, please give me the strength, the ability, and the intelligence to get across this river. And poof, he turns into a woman. She took out the map, she looked at it, found the bridge, and walked across. Thank you very much.